Today, quantum computing and quantum encryption bring in billions of dollars in research money. A few decades ago, physicists had largely abandoned these outer reaches of quantum mechanics. Money for physics dried up after the boom years of science funding at the beginning of the Cold War. Then, a strange thing happened. A few maverick physicists got together in Berkeley and revived quantum mechanics. And since this were the early 70s, the heyday of the counterculture, they came up with some far-out ideas, like connecting quantum physics and Eastern mysticism. A few even managed to get CIA funding for research on ESP. Science historian David Kaiser tells their story in a book called How the Hippies Saved Physics. He tells Steve Paulson that these were some of the most brilliant young physicists of their day.
And they realized they weren't just out of work or underemployed. They had really deep-seated, burning, you know, passionate questions about physics, about the most fundamental questions in physics.
And a lot of these questions had to do with quantum physics in particular.
Especially quantum physics, some with Einstein's relativity. But you're right, a lot of it had to do with these, you know, sort of famous mysteries that had not been solved then, arguably not really solved now.
So there was a real philosophical bent to this. I mean, this was sort of getting away from the, I don't know, maybe more nuts and bolts side of physics and asking the big questions, really, about what makes our universe tick.
Absolutely. And the group that became, they formed this group called the Fundamental Physics Group. And so that's what really drew them together. Just as you say, these sort of deepest mysteries about the quantum world.
Now, partly what's fascinating about this story is actually the people who really founded modern physics, going back to the 1920s and 30s, these were the giants, especially the people who created quantum mechanics. Einstein, Niels Bohr, Schrodinger, Heisenberg, Pauli, they were all philosophical. I mean, some of them had kind of a mystical bent too.
They did.
And then something happened and that all seemed to go away.
That's right. I'm not sure it went away. It got shunted aside. You're right. Those deep philosophical, often kind of Eastern mystical tainted questions, that literally kept that first generation up at night. And they would argue, they would cry, they'd call each other names. And this is deeply passionate stuff in the 20s into the 1930s. And then sort of what it meant to be a physicist went through a very significant change, especially in the United States, but even in other parts of the world, during and after World War II, where the catchphrase, the sort of joking catchphrase became shut up and calculate, right? Our job here is not to, you know, worry about whether Hindu scriptures elucidate to the meaning of, you know, electron.
So to skip back to the 1970s, when these young, as you say, hippie physicists kind of took up the mantle again, what were some of the more philosophical questions that attracted them?
You know, there were many on the plate, but one topic more than any really captured them, and that was something known as Bell's theorem. It was named for an Irish physicist, John Bell, who had thought very deeply, very philosophically about the meaning of quantum theory, what it might imply about ultimate reality, and had learned as a kind of professional survival move to just keep it to himself. He literally said he had just had to, you know, make sure his colleagues didn't find out about that. He'd do it at the night, you know, at nighttime and so on.
And the radical idea here was this notion of quantum entanglement, that certain particles that had been connected could then sort of end up on opposite sides of the universe and still have some connection. And this seemed to defy the laws of causality.
Exactly right. And so the idea had been kicking around in some loose form, right back to the golden era. Einstein and Bohr had debated something very close to that, and Schrodinger too. Schrodinger, in fact, coined the term entanglement.
And Einstein hated it.
He called this
spooky action at a distance.
That's right. He huffed this. If that's what quantum theory predicts, then so much the worse for quantum theory. Exactly. He was not pleased by that. And so John Bell came to this more or less on his own as a young student, read some of the older accounts by people like Einstein and Bohr, and realized that the question really hadn't been solved. And his amazing triumph in a very short article, was published as, I think, only 5 pages, I mean, it's not a long treatise, was to prove, to really mathematically demonstrate that, like it or not, quantum theory requires these kinds of long-distance instantaneous effects.
So when did John Bell publish this original paper that proved Bell's theorem?
It came out in a very obscure little physics journal in 1964 and then, you know, disappeared. It was an unknown journal. It was a topic that was still not attracting much interest. It vanished.
Again, this is so fascinating because, I mean, this is a radical idea. This challenges everything that we know about causality, one of the fundamental ideas in how the world works. And no one picked up on it until some of these young renegade physicists did what, 10 years later or so?
That's right. So one thing that really fascinates me is this is an article, Bell's article from 64. Today, it's on sort of all of our lips, right? By any way you want to slice or dice it, this is one of the most influential articles of the 20th century, arguably of any time, of any period in the history of physics since the Earth has cooled. I mean, that's the kind of stakes. And so how can we square that with this unrelenting obscurity that greeted the article, as you say, for its first 10 or even 15 years? What captured me was that this weird group, this eccentric and colorful group, the Fundamental Physics Group based in Berkeley, they dominated worldwide publications on this topic starting in the mid-1970s when they first came together as a group.
And they wanted to prove it. At least some people did, right? Experimentally. I mean, so to take it just out of the realm of theory and experimentally show that this was real.
That's right. In fact, the very first laboratory test of Bell's theorem over this quantum entanglement was performed by a kind of founding core member of this group. His name is John Clauser, a magnificent physicist. He also had kind of caught the bug of this philosophical or foundational questions in grad school, was told in no uncertain terms, you know, that you'll ruin your career, kid. Put it aside. He grudgingly did a different dissertation topic. And then, you know, the bottom fell out. He barely got a postdoc despite his, you know, very strong credentials. And then he convinced his postdoc supervisor to let him basically, quote unquote, waste half his time by trying to mount a genuine laboratory test of entanglement because the question just wouldn't leave him alone. He said he got very good at dumpster diving. I mean, it was basically a zero cost experiment practically, yeah. Duct taped together. And believe it or not, with the help of one grad student, they mounted a real experimental test. And they found the predictions of quantum theory spot on.
And then there was another idea that still is hot today, but it's that there was some connection between quantum physics and human consciousness. And that seemed to be the thing that really got people going.
That's right. And again, the group in Berkeley didn't invent that, but they kind of resuscitated it. They saw that as an incredibly deep foundational question. The role of the observer had obsessed Heisenberg and Bohr back in the 20s and 30s.
And so, and just to put it in perspective, mm-hmm. I mean, the reason why this is such a radical idea is it's the idea that the way we think helps to create material reality.
The questions we ask of the world change the state of the world, at least in the way these folks saw it.
And then the story gets stranger. And again, mm-hmm. this was the 70s. So, you know, the height of the counterculture movement, the beginnings of the human potential movement, a lot of interest in psychic phenomena. Uri Geller, the Israeli who sort of made his name apparently bending spoons, but with his mind, mm-hmm. you know, without actually touching them. There was this thought that somehow quantum physics would help explain the paranormal.
That's right. And so world headquarters, or at least nationwide headquarters for that blossoming, was the Bay Area. And so, for example, when Geller first came to the United States, he was whisked off to the Stanford Research Institute, a sort of spin-off defense contractor, high Cold War, you know, defense contracting site. And he was subjected to careful, controlled laboratory experimentation, right, for mind reading, for telepathy, as well as for what was called psychokinetic, bending spoons and things.
And some of these people, I mean, some of these founding members of the Fundamental Physics Group tested Geller, and they said this was legitimate.
Well, they were hired as kind of house theorists. So the folks at SRI included, again, very smart, extremely well-trained physicists. Some had written textbooks on quantum mechanics. They were no dopes, right? Very serious and very smart.
But there were skeptics, of course. And one of the most famous skeptics was a magician, James Randi, the amazing Randi, mm-hmm. who said, look, I can bend spoons too, just by sleight of hand. Did they disprove Uri Geller?
They think they did. I don't have a dog in this fight. I'll put it that way.
I mean, this is still a controversy to this day.
It is. And what amazed me as an historian, if I put my historian hat on for a moment, was a kind of mini Cold War, right, of the kind of claims, counterclaims, bunking, debunking, so to speak.
Now, one of the remarkable pieces of the story is that a lot of the research was actually research specifically into psychic phenomena and maybe this connection to quantum physics was funded by the CIA.
Yeah, we know that now. We know the CIA and actually more importantly, over time, in terms of just dollars spent, the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency, the sort of internal DIA, between them, they spent something like $25 million on an active research program, a military program in, we might call it, offensive mind reading or defensive mind reading.
And the reason for this was that the Soviets had already been doing it, and they were worried that the Soviets were going to beat them to the punch.
Look, it's the Cold War. How do you get money out of the government, especially the military? The Ruskies are doing it more of it and better. What we do know is that it was funded handsomely, continuously for about 20 years. It was supposedly shut down in 1995. The Cold War had ended. And then there have been claims, I can't substantiate, that some of these programs were reactivated after September 11th. So maybe they're still going on now. I certainly don't know.
Now, one of the questions that your book raises is, how do we draw the line between legitimate science and pseudoscience? And how do we separate maybe what would seem to be crackpot science from simply science that's ahead of its time?
It's a great question. It's a question that I have real sympathy for, I mean, in my own physics world, and let alone as an historian. It's often phrased, how I phrase it in the book as well, is a classic philosophical problem called demarcation. The great philosopher of science, Karl Popper, raised this in the early and middle decades of the 20th century. There must be some litmus test, Popper hoped. Why should we have confidence that astrology might not be worthy of real scientific attention, but Einstein's notion of warping space-time is? On the face of it, they both sound kind of nutty, right? And so Popper was really hoping to find these kind of golden criteria that he said would demarcate, you know, real science from pretenders, from pseudoscience or fringe. But what I don't think is that there are universal laws we can do it ahead of time. That's my historian's way of saying it's always messy, right? It's something like pornography in the sense that you know it when you see it. And that's not philosophically satisfying. I think it's historically right. I don't want the book to be read as saying, anything goes, say whatever you want, it's all real science, man. Right? That's not that's not the message. I mean, it mattered to me deeply that these folks were well-trained, earnest, smart, and motivated by a wide range of things. Do I think any old thing is going to go? I don't think so. But it's a real issue, right, when we think about climate change denial. And it's not just the nature of consciousness and quantum theory. You know, what's real science today is a hot-button issue. It's deeply political. So I don't want to say anything goes, whoever wants to say they're doing science is doing science. What I don't think we're going to find are these golden, you know, bright lines in the sand.
David Kaiser is a physicist and historian of science at MIT. He talked with Steve Paulson about his book, How the Hippies Saved Physics. By the way, this group of maverick physicists not only helped create quantum information science, two of its members also wrote landmark books suggesting a link between physics and spirituality, The Tao of Physics and The Dancing Wu Li Masters.